Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Now, Dr. Shane Bergen is back to do some science debunking, or rather myth debunking, with a little bit of the application of science. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
We are looking this morning at myths, common myths that people have about their bodies. The first, the oldest of shibboleths, has to be, are you more likely to catch a cold going out with wet hair or not?
No, you're not. And I think we've all been warned about this one, right, down through the years, about you wouldn't go out with hair like that. Well, if anyone knows my hair, they wouldn't go out whether it's wet or dry. But
you have sensitive hair, Shane.
Thank you. The idea is that going out with wet hair, you'd somehow end up catching a cold. Of course, colds are viruses. They're coronaviruses. So remember those. And so we inhale them and they interact with our system. And depending on your immune system, you'd either develop symptoms or not. It'll either be active or inactive. But getting wet doesn't make you more susceptible to catching a cold. Studies have been done on this. There is, would you believe, the Common Cold Centre in the UK where they do research. Because, of course, it's the well-known thing. We haven't a cure for the common cold.
What if you were harbouring a coronavirus, your immune system had kept it at bay, but you gave yourself a chill? How much more likely does it become that you will develop a cold?
And that's where there is research done that suggests there's some truth to granny's advice, or granddad's advice, right?
Aha, yes. You see, and there was you emphatically dismissing granny's wisdom.
Would I dare? So what they did was they found people who were willing to sit and put their feet in cold water for 20 minutes. Right? These are always PhD students looking for a few quid. And they then looked and saw how whether they developed cold or not in the following days. And what they found was that if they were already harbouring the virus and it was inactive, that they were more likely then to basically, you know, trigger a cold rather than catch a cold.
There's a methodological problem with that survey, though, isn't there? Because you don't know if it's correlation or causation that that they went on and developed the cold.
That's science 101, Philip, of course. Is there a cause, or is there just a link between these things? And they don't know. There's a lot more research to be done, a lot more tubs of ice cold water and poor victims.
Okay, so we can't actually answer this one conclusively yet. The chances are you might, if you're harbouring something somewhere in your body, give rise to an increased risk of developing the full-blown disease.
Yeah, but there are things we can do to prevent us from getting colds, which is eat well, sleep well, not be stressed, all those things that our grannies would have also told us.
There was a presenter in this organisation who once upon a time used to meticulously lay toilet paper out around the toilet seat and then leave this very intricate arrangement. One assumes because he was in fear of catching something from a toilet seat.
Dare I ask how you know this?
Because I would walk into the toilets after him and go, my God, that arrangement must have taken ages to put in place. Can you get infections from public toilet seats?
Yeah, you can, but it's not that likely, right? So people are, you know, they go in and they're very fussy about it, just like your colleague. And there may even be covers for the toilet seat that are available. The idea being here that the place will be full of germs and that you're going to, by just sitting on the loo, pick one up. That's very unlikely, right? Mainly because you have skin, right? And so the virus or the bacteria that might be on the rim of the loo is not that likely to go into your body unless you have a cut
open
or something
or cracked
like that.
Skin, I was going to say.
Yeah, or up the place that the waste came out of. Yeah, exactly. But that's very unlikely, right? Otherwise, we'd be getting infections the whole time. There was an extensive study done in the United States of public restrooms, right, where they went around and swabbed things and looked at likelihood of catching something relative to other spaces. And because we go in there and we wee and we poo, there is more, particularly from the poo, chances of there being, you know, stuff around. But it's not that likely that you're going to take it in through your body. In aerosol form, you could breathe it in, right? But again, it's not that likely that you're going to do that and you're going to get sick from it. One interesting thing I read from the study was that when you flush the loo, right, there's a very important reason that loos have lids. You flush the loo and leave the lid open, you get this aerosol plume that's sent out into the room.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and there can be all of the kind of fine fecal matter in that, and that's not very pleasant. So they recommend closing the lid because you kind of suppress the plume. Also, not putting your bag on the floor, and certainly not taking your mobile out, right?
For all of those people who have spent many pleasurable hours sitting on a toilet with their mobile phone, Dr. Shane Bergen says, stop that right now. But it is a good point, isn't it, that public toilets should come with a hook on the back of the door so you can hang your bag and all of your personal possessions and not have to be putting them
on no-brainer.
The floor.
Ugh. And wash your hands. People have this idea that I have to get out of here quickly, so they rush with the hand washing. So it's 20 seconds, right? Meant to sing happy birthday. Isn't that the one we learned during COVID when you're washing your hands? And that really does have an impact, is that the likelihood of you picking the stuff up is most likely on your hands, and then you put your hand in your eye or in your mouth or something like that, and that's how you might get sick. But I have to stress, it is far more dangerous to hold it than it is to avoid going to the loo. Basically, avoiding going to the loo is not good for you. So, like, just
you mean waiting until you get home?
Exactly. Yeah, just go to the loo if you really need to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Five-year-olds listening.
Okay, moving on.
Yes.
And this is a really fascinating one, and one that I am guilty of spreading false information on myself. Do you lose most of your heat from the top of your head or not?
You are no more likely to lose heat from your head than anywhere else in your body. And this myth, and again, I've heard it many times, came from a study that the US Army did in the 50s. Where they took victims or soldiers and they put them in Arctic conditions.
Subjects.
Exactly. Research subjects. And they put them in, they're always PhD students or soldiers, people who can't say no, basically. And they put them in coats and Arctic gear and into like frigid temperatures. And the only parts of their body that were exposed were their heads. And so unsurprisingly, about 40% of the heat that they had left their bodies through their heads.
As somebody said, not that long afterwards, well, hang on, did you put them in there with their backsides exposed or with their knees exposed? No, you didn't. So you can't make that conclusion.
Absolutely. Now, we'd probably feel temperature changes more sensitively around different parts of our bodies, right? Like your chest or something like that. There is a lot of sense about keeping your core warm, you know, that idea of you're going out, and as long as your core is warm, then your extremes can be that little bit chillier. But you're not any more likely to lose heat from the top of your head. And even though I have a fine head of hair, I'd always wear a woolly hat on a cold day because it helps.
Do you need to wait an hour after eating before you can swim?
No, you don't. Get in the pool, but just be careful about it. Of course, like the proof of this one basically is, how do people die from swimming accidents, right? And there has been extensive studies done here, because it is the number one reason for children to die in China, actually, is drowning. And so they looked into the reasons, and the main reasons are that the child was out of their depth, literally. They may not have learned how to swim. The pool may not have been safe in terms of the edges of it. They couldn't get out. Or there wasn't somebody looking at them to keep an eye on them.
I see a problem with the methodology in this one as well. We don't get to ask the child that died, did they have a stitch or a pain in their side as they were drowning, do we?
No, we don't. But we can ask people who maybe feel uncomfortable in swimming pools and don't die, like, you know, have you ever had a stitch or a cramp? It's like the one about the swan and, you know, breaking your arm. Have you ever met anyone that's actually experienced that, right?
No.
So with the swimming, the idea is somehow that you get into the pool, that you'd be very vigorous in your exercise, that blood would be removed from your intestinal system to go to your skin and your muscles, and that might leave you feeling cramped or nauseous. Studies have been done, and they found that this really only happens for elite athletes who are very much pushing themselves to the limit. If you're getting into the pool or the sea and you're splashing around and doing a few strokes, you're no more likely to get a cramp after eating, or a stitch, both of which we don't fully understand physiologically, than you are from walking around or running.
One of the dopiest ones that was ever pushed around was probably a question first asked by somebody who was only using 10% of their brain. Is it the case that human beings only use 10% of their brain matter?
No, it's not. So we use all our brains all the time. Of course, the question as to whether we use them well or efficiently is a whole other debate. But we do use our brains the whole time. And the proof of this is our brains are very energy hungry. And so from an evolutionary point of view, if we were only using 10% of our brains all the time, we'd only have 10% of the brain. Our brains are very flexible and adaptable, i.e. we can learn. But when you're learning, you're just making new connections within an already fully processing and busy brain.
And if you don't believe the evolutionary argument, well, then we've been putting people in MRI machines and showing exactly how much of their brains they do use for quite a long time.
Absolutely. Again, with the PhD students unable to say no to the volunteer.
I know. Who would want to spend any amount of time inside an MRI machine? What's your process for doing this? You're doing a little bit more than Googling this information, please tell me.
I am. So I always, and all scientists start with Google, right? It's a fantastic place to start. But I would look at research papers and I would look and I would be more likely to trust sources that are peer reviewed. As in, you know, if I make a claim about something as a scientist, other scientists have to come in and test, you know, basically common sense test and really rigorously look at what I have done. So when I'm looking at sources, I look for peer review. If there is doubt or if there is sort of disagreement, I'll go and look at multiple sources. Of course, the most likely thing for me to do then is to ask other scientists and to figure it out.
Very good. Shane Bergen, more fun at the same time again next week. Please, thank you very much. Get your questions into us to put on to or put under Shane's nose and he will do his best to answer them. Now, at just coming up to 11 o'clock, I need to take a break.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.